Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Welcome, Lawyers, Guns, and Money listeners. My name is Rob Farley, and again, I have with me Daniel Bessner. You will remember Daniel from our previous podcast where we talked about his book, Democracy in Exile. We are going to talk today, extend that conversation, and talk a little bit about what has a, sort of a fermenting conversation on what a progressive foreign policy should look like. And this conversation is emerging from a lot of different places, but in particular from the Sanders campaign, from the Sanders 2016, but then more from the Sanders 2020 presidential campaign, but also from a variety of other places. How are you doing today, Daniel?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for asking.
I guess to propel this forward, right, sort of the lesson that we are drawing sort of from the argument that we're talking about now with respect to Speier and this creation of sort of extra-democratic institutions that channel foreign policy in a particular direction. So is perhaps one of the lessons that we take from this, or that you take from this, because you've also commented pretty extensively fairly recently about you've been part of this conversation about what a new progressive foreign policy looks like, right? And what I'm sort of hearing here is that, you know, part of this question is sort of really to genuinely debate what progressive priorities in foreign policy should be. But another part of this conversation should be avoiding the sort of decision-making or the sort of institution building that we see Speier and people like Speier doing at the dawn of the Cold War that sort of produces outcomes which are at such variance with sort of what could have been done. Does that make any sense at all?
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I just think it's also important to understand that people like Speier, and I would even put to some degree Morgenthau in this category, mm-hmm. didn't think that what they were doing was actually against democracy. And what I mean by that is that what they were arguing is that the crisis of nuclear weapons, essentially the crisis of nuclear weapons first, and then second, the analogizing of the Soviet Union with Nazi Germany provided, essentially engendered a culture of crisis, a geopolitical terrain of crisis that allowed the sort of emergency measures of these extra-democratic institutions to exist. And then once the menace had ended, you could get rid of these extra-democratic institutions and you could develop new means to have a foreign policy be actually made in a more democratic fashion. But the problem is that we all know the Cold War never ended and the crisis never ended, and that even after the Cold War, the United States has essentially, you know, during admittedly an interregnum in the 1990s, but essentially has jumped from crisis to crisis. So I think it even goes beyond sort of developing what a progressive foreign policy should be. But I really, what I'm trying to do in a lot of those pieces is encourage a rethinking of a lot of first principles of what the United States' role in the world should be. Mm-hmm. You know, should we be a military primacist, primacist nation? Should we essentially jump from crisis to crisis? Should we view everything through the prism of the trauma of the 1930s? So I think what I'm doing there is also not just what should we do tomorrow with, you know, for example, what should the left-wing policy on the Uyghurs be, but also what should we return to some of these foundational assumptions that have guided American foreign policy for almost a century at this point and really rethink them in light of the various real disasters that have occurred under American hegemony and American empire, which is, of course, gets us into the liberal international order debate and what I think to be is a largely misguided and historically inaccurate way of understanding what the United States actually did in the world for most of the 20th and early 21st centuries.
Right. So my colleague Dan Nixon can't be with us today because he's not feeling well. I know that I mean, he's written a lot on the subjects of, you know, hegemony and subjects of empire, right? And how we use the term empire and what it means to us. And I think that he would probably have a bone to pick with how you have used the word empire in some fashion, right? Like in the Fellow Travelers piece you discussed, you know, perhaps we should think about Saudi Arabia, Israel as sort of outpost of empire, right? Which I think might generate some hackle. It certainly made me sort of pause, and it might generate some hackles. But I guess for you, and so for pushing forward, so not just for you, but sort of thinking in sort of broader terms about this relationship between hegemony, empire, liberal international order, and a world order in which the United States is merely by far the largest and most powerful country, right? What is the difference between all of those things?
Well, sure. So I think a lot of this actually just goes to different disciplinary incentives. Mm-hmm. So I think political scientists, you know, would want to say these are the eight characteristics of hegemony and these are the eight characteristics of empire. And this is how they differ. But I think historians are just fundamentally less interested in that question. And so when historians use it, I think what we're essentially doing is describing a real power relationship of domination, essentially from a metropole to various other nodes throughout the world. So it's more of a common sense definition where historians basically use hegemony and empire interchangeably. And I think they mm-hmm. do some meaningful way because it expresses something real about how the United States operates in the world and how the United States forces other nations and other peoples to abide by its wishes in an imperial manner. Now, I think a lot of the problem with
political scientists, I think, would go really hostile to that very quickly.
Disciplinary ways of knowing, and then one can argue with political scientists about what empires are they really relying on. It really mm-hmm. only comes from sort of the quote unquote Western imagination. Like, are you really talking about the Safavids or even the Ottomans, et cetera, et cetera? And I would actually say that the largest imperial the United States is basically a blending of sort of a British imperial experiences and other sort of land-based imperial experiences that largely stand outside mm-hmm. to what it takes into the IR canon. And then we could go back and forth for days, right. really. But I think that the disciplinary incentives are not that. We could argue over them forever, but they're ultimately not that interesting. I think people, political scientists who search for patterns over time, are engaged in a different project than historians who are basically trying to establish diachronic relationships about how power works in a way. And then it also goes to the political valence of the term, which I think is something that can't be ignored. And I think historians are much more willing to admit sort of the political, maybe not more admit, but are a little more comfortable with the political implications of using empire, because I think they're further to the left in general than political scientists, particularly on questions of American power in the world. Or at least that's been my sense as someone who's studies world for his career.
No, I think that sense is quite right. But I want to actually drag this back to sort of the very last way I phrased it, because this last way I phrased it, or the last thing I said, because I think that this is actually quite consequential for how we think about what a progressive foreign policy is. And especially – and one thing I liked about Your Fellow Travelers piece, but also in the Nation piece, is this sort of recognition, right, that the left – has, you know, finally has both an opportunity and a responsibility to move beyond critique into advocacy and policy development, right? Into sort of weighing the sort of genuine costs and benefits of particular kinds of foreign policy thinking, which has, you know, for the first time since the 1960s or even before, there ought to be sort of general, genuine, positive left-wing thinking about what foreign policy should look like rather than sort of just arguments about what's wrong. But, you know, what is then, and I think this matters for intervention and it matters for sort of how we think about the United States throwing its weight around and so forth. What if the United States were merely a normal country that simply had a GDP that was three times larger than anyone else's in the world, right? How is that different than an imperial power or a hegemonic power in the way you think about it, in the way that historians think about it, right? Because even if the United States were merely sort of normal, the things that it would do on a daily basis would be deeply consequential for the peoples in every part of the world, right? They would be transformative of how politics and how economics and society functions all around the world simply by the means of the existence of the United States as this sort of massive, massive economic and military power, right?
Yeah. Well, I think the major difference is the United States wouldn't be telling the world what to do and wouldn't be basically creating a particular power arrangement in the world where it was mm-hmm. the buck stops. United States. So I think that you could be a powerful nation without involving oneself so directly in the world. So it's, for example, get rid of those 800 bases, right? Mm-hmm. Really rethink what NATO is in a post-Cold War world. Maybe you don't need it. Maybe Europeans should be totally responsible for their own defenses. Maybe if you have a progressive government, particularly a socialist government in the United States, you would actually try to reform some of the global hierarchies that currently allow the global North to dominate the global South. And then particularly for me, as someone who's very much not a nationalist and is very interested in developing a post-nationalist world, think about how you could rearrange the interactions between the United States, Mexico, and Canada to create a truly democratic and non-hierarchical, or at least not obviously there'll be hierarchies, but as non-hierarchical mm-hmm. as possible, political organization in the North American continent. How you could invest, the best foreign policy for me, in some sense, in terms of the Middle East, would be investing in alternative energy at home, right, so that our allies don't have to.
Right. I mean, I'm completely on board with that, right? But investing in alternative energy at home, right? And so let me phrase this somewhat differently, right? And this is not, it's not the policy that I would prefer. It's not the policy that a lot of people would have preferred with respect to the energy crisis of last decade, right? When oil prices went up very much because of the actions of the United States, right? When the launching the Iraq War and so forth, and it drives hydrocarbon prices through the roof and so forth.
But I wouldn't even focus on given climate change is to me, the important question is not about hydrocarbon prices, uh-huh. right? Like we're still talking in these idiom that doesn't make sense, in my opinion, right. for the world that's being created right now. Right. So this is why I think it's important to really return to first principles and assumptions about what type of power we're going to be in the world and what type of nation we're going to be in the world, if that makes sense. Right. I feel like we could get lost in these sort of mid-level details that are ultimately unimportant when you're facing potentially existential challenges like climate change. Right. We need to totally rethink international relations in a meaningful way.
Sure. But let me finish here. Right. One consequence of the United States invading Iraq and then driving oil prices through the roof was, and this was completely outside of the intentions of the United States in doing so, right? But it was to create sort of political ripple effects that were transformative politics in places like Iran and Venezuela, right? The United States, in some sense, George W. Bush, in some sense, is the author of Chavismo, right? I mean, it enables the creation of the state that Chavez wants to create because oil prices are being driven through the roof, right? And that enables Chavez to undertake a number of steps that he wanted to take, completely outside of the intent of the United States in doing so, right? Then the United States undertakes a different set of policies, which are fracking and hydrocarbon production here, right, which again transform the entire playing field for the rest of the world and completely undermine the project of Venezuelan socialism, right? Again, I mean, and this one is sort of more intentional, right? But the ripple, the after effects are not sort of well thought out or exactly what we wanted to do when we did these things, right? So, I mean, this is what I'm getting at when I'm talking about sort of this difference between the United States as part of an active hegemonic project and the United States simply being gigantic, right? That both of these are quite consequential in terms of policy.
Right. And ideally, at least what we would be building toward, at least what my own political opinion is, to be building toward a more equal world. And so I think a lot of the questions of distribution are essentially not questions of technology or technique, but are essentially questions of politics. So what I would ideally want is the United States to serve as this powerful nation, a redistributive nation, not only to within its own borders, but externally as well. And so this is what I mean by essentially a post-nationalist international relations. Now, of course, this is going to take generations to build a consensus for this, but I think it's necessary if sort of, human beings could take the next stage in quote-unquote their history, right? The nation state is a particular form of political organization. It's not natural in any meaningful way, and we need to start thinking in more humanist directions, is what my answer to that question would be.
All right, so then let me take this again one step farther. Consequential changes that the United States makes internally and consequential changes that the United States makes with respect to something like energy policy, right, because we've been talking about it, are going to be indistinguishable in many parts of the world from the direct imposition of empire.
Right.
From the perspective of Venezuela, it doesn't actually matter that the United States is trying to destroy Venezuelan socialism, which it quite clearly is, or that the United States accidentally destroyed Venezuelan socialism by engaging in fracking, right? The consequences are largely the same, and they are both perceived and entertained and understood as the United States engaging in imperial activity.
Of course. And I mean, and this is the consequence of 500 years of colonialism and imperialism. And it's not going to end in a day. But what we need to do is start having this sort of vision that we begin deconstructing these various hierarchies that really have allowed the global north to totally dominate and rapaciously exploit the entire global south. So I think this is what we – and so the question that you're asking is how do we do that? And I think we have to create truly internationally democratic institutions, unlike the UN, which are able to actually incorporate the voices of peoples that the United States and the West and the North Atlantic really have exploited in a meaningful way. So this isn't going to happen tomorrow, and there's a good reason for Venezuelans to see the United States as behavior as imperial, because it has been for most of modern Latin American history. I would even say all of modern Latin American history. And so the question is, does that fact prevent you from taking the sorts of steps that I think are going to be needed to create the type of humanist world that I'm expecting, that I want to see happen? And that's going to take generations. And so I think we need to think in terms of various timescales. So instead of only focusing on the, tomorrow, which we should focus on, but we should also need to focus on medium-term timescales and long-term timescales and trying to get the world and incorporating these together and trying to get the world that we want to see. So that would be my answer to that question.
Right. Okay. And I mean, it's a good answer, although it feels to me like an apolitical answer, right? It feels to me like Venezuela is going to get burned no matter what, right? Because I mean, and I don't want to come just stick on, but the oil question is very, very interesting to me, right? The oil question is sort of deeply interesting because it has created so many sort of communities of interest around the world that are sort of so tightly tied to the production and use of particular kinds of hydrocarbon that any sort of change that you do, whether you're pursuing climate change or you're sort of changing patterns of usage or you're changing patterns of recovery, right? Because that's what the fracking revolution is about changing patterns of recovery, that the consequences are always destructive and disruptive, right? And the consequences always sniff of empire, even. And I guess I don't find it satisfying that sort of in the end, this all comes down to a north-south conflict, right? I mean, I think the people of Scotland in many ways feel this in the same way as the people of Venezuela, right? The people of Scotland have sort of a much more thorough and firm safety net, right? But U.S. fracking essentially undercuts, undermines, and destroys the logic of Scottish independence.
Yeah, of course.
Even though that's not something we cared about or wanted to do, right? It was simply a consequence of, more or less, perhaps less democratic decision making within the United States.
Yeah, I mean, there are internal hierarchies within countries just as there are hierarchies between countries. And I think that the real answer is that you're not going to erase history in a day. And so even if I were to say that we're going to then redistribute resources from the global north to the global south or within countries or whatever it may be, there's going to be particular communities that are going to be harmed. And that there are also communities that developed over time due to the various exploitative arrangements that were created that are not going to be happy if the United States does that or not even the United States, the places that have the resources to do that. To me, that's not a reason not to do it. I mean, like, it's going to happen. You're going to have to do it anyway, and that there are clearly going to be problems along the way. But I think you need to start moving beyond the world that we have to the world that we want to see created in a meaningful way that actually harms, for example, capital at home or the various policy professionals that rely on the continuation of American empire for jobs, prestige, and professional advancement. So those are all everything that you said is correct. But to me, that's not an argument against doing it in
It does seem like something that requires a broad technocracy, though.
Yes, but you're right. You need technocracy, and no, I'm not saying you need you don't need technocracy. I think this gets into the role of the intellectual, and I think for too long intellectuals have focused on technocratic questions when the privilege of a university position for those few of us who have it in an academic job market is to really focus on larger questions of philosophy and first principles. So I don't. Of course, you need technocrats, and of course, you need bureaucrats to basically attenuate the suffering that will inevitably occur as history happens. You know, there will always be suffering, but. Is this what really intellectuals should be dedicating themselves to at this particular historical juncture?
All right. So I think my last question, and this is a large question, is sort of it's meta in a certain way, but I think we've been dancing around it, and I think it's worth engaging with. So if we envision the United States sort of as a means to a progressive foreign policy, or we imagine the United States with a progressive foreign policy in pursuit of some larger progressive end, and we can envision that in terms of climate change, right, the management of climate change. We can envision that in terms of the management, the more just management of a redistributive project internationally. We can imagine that as the creation of democratic international institutions, or at least international institutions which are more democratic than the ones we have. It seems to me that any foreign policy goal of this sort, we really have to worry about engaging with two problems. And the first problem is the one that we've already alluded to, that by doing just about anything on the international stage, the United States essentially steps on and squashes other actors, right, in a way that feels sort of desperately imperial to the people who are being squashed. You know, climate change is really obvious, right? If the United States successfully pursues steps to mitigate climate change, it will squash lots and lots of people in the developing world, at least in the short term. And my second part of this sort of goes back to what we talked about in the Speyer half of this podcast, the first half of this podcast, which is sort of the problem that he understood. How do you maintain a democratic consensus around steps to either mitigate climate change or manage China or to manage redistribution? How do you maintain that kind of popular democratic consensus without creating extra democratic institutions to pursue those ends? So right, those are two giant questions, and you can really sort of feel free to engage with either or both of them.
Sure. Well, I'll take the last one first. I think the first way that you try to create that democratic consensus is to adopt a socialist politics at home that takes true redistribution as its means and as its ends. So I think people are going to be far more likely to listen to things about how we need to reduce consumption, about how we need to really think about where we get our energy from, how we need to maybe reconceive of things like plastics and the consumer capitalism that we have if we don't live in the enormously unequal society that we do. So I think with regards to the latter question in terms of maintaining a democratic consensus for policies on like carbon emissions and climate change, more generally, you have to connect the domestic and the international. And so a redistributive policy is, I think, step one. And I think that the elites, the people who actually hold power in society, need to adopt a far less cynical and pessimistic understanding of quote-unquote ordinary people's or the average citizen's ability to engage in high-level political discussion, particularly if the redistributive efforts are effective. People will ideally have more time to consider things like foreign policy and their larger role in the world. So I think these efforts are connected. And then you don't engage in a propagandistic effort where you essentially try to force people to believe one thing, but you engage in an effort of discussion and an effort of debate where you actually try to bring people into the policy process, into the policymaking process in a meaningful way, whether doing what Woodrow Wilson did when he tried to gin up support for the League of Nations, or even what people in the 1930s and 1940s did who worked for the Brookings Institution, where they, for example, would go out into the United States and actually hold foreign policy discussions. And these things could be government funded, and they could be much larger efforts in order to try to get people in order to create a democratic consensus around issues like climate change, around issues like not fighting a cold war with China and things along those lines. Now, in relation to the first question, which
I have to pause you there, Daniel, because I mean, That sounds to me to be strikingly apolitical, right? I mean, I say this, I suppose, as a political scientist, and maybe we just assume levels of conflict. But
what do you mean apolitical?
I mean apolitical in that, it sort of assumes away factionalism and political conflict and arguments over sorts and kinds of redistribution, all of the things that we would expect to be endemic even under sort of a different set of socioeconomic relations, right?
Disagreement and debate, right? Of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to assume that away, but I think once the political economy is more equal, there will actually be more room for truer debates.
Okay. All right. So let's go to the second part, or the first part.
Okay. I just want to emphasize, I don't see necessarily how it's apolitical because it emerges from a socialist redistribution. So, of course, there'll be factions, there'll be debates, and there'll be discussions, but the idea is that you actually have these debates in the open and they're not made by a clerisy totally disconnected from any sort of democratic mechanism, which also
I would say that there's sort of there is it is apolitical in the sense that, there's a foundational assumption here that under a social/economic ordering, that many of the foundational political questions are essentially going to be resolved, right? And so we're just kind of arguing about the details. Is kind of what it sounds like to me.
Not necessarily foundational political questions, but I think once foundational material issues are resolved in a meaningful way, of course, they'll never be 100% resolved, but I do think that'll open up a larger space for debate as opposed to reactionary identity politics. I do think that will certainly allow for larger spaces of debate once people are not worried, for example, about where their next meal will come from or whether they'll be able to pay rent or whether if they get cancer they'll go bankrupt. I do think that will change the tenor of political debate almost naturally.
I am deeply skeptical of that.
Why?
Because I think that there is very little evidence to suggest that sort of changing the material foundations, whether it's giving people more health care or increasing their material prosperity over time, anything like that, makes politics nicer and sort of less vicious.
No, I'm not saying it'll make it less vicious, but also what evidence are you referring to? Where is there little evidence?
I mean, people now, say people in the 1970s, right, even if we want to sort of create a space where we're not talking about sort of the titanic growth of economic inequality in the United States. But even if we sort of talk about Piketty's post-Cold War, post-World War II economic utopia, in which you have sort of dramatic reductions in inequality, we see sort of horrifically nasty politics in the United States and across the Western world, despite sort of rapidly increasing... Well, I mean, I don't think we're going to solve this right now, right? I mean, I don't, but you know, I mean,
I'm not Pollyanna-ish. I don't think things like racism, intensity politics are going to go away. I think that's naive, and those are things that are going to take generations to go on. But I do think that once you have a foundational material politics, again, there will be different types of discussions happening. Of course there'll be racism. I mean, if we're talking about Piketty's utopia, Jim Crow didn't end to the mid-1960s, so how much of a utopia was that? But I think there's a lot of issues going on, and of course I think that there'll be political conflict. Obviously, we're not going to ever reach a quote-unquote communist utopia. This will never happen. But I do think that it is meaningful to try to reduce people's material uncertainty, and I do believe that over time that will lead to a different sort of – that will help lead, if other things – also go along with it, for example, dealing with patriarchy, dealing with racism, dealing with the global hierarchies between global north and global south. If those issues are also addressed at the same time, I do think different sorts of politics will be available. And I'd also like to add one thing that, I mean, I'm a historian. If you're looking at this from a macro historical lens, I mean, we haven't had modernity for that long. So I think that we should always be erring on the side of more political imagination as opposed to less political imagination, or at least that's my inclination, right? We've only been doing this for about 200 years, and human beings have only been settled for roughly 10,000 years. So we're kind of new at this. So I think that we should be like more right. expansive.
And I guess my only request would be that we ought not to imagine politics away, right? That we should expand our political imagination, but we ought not to imagine them away, imagine that political, the, sort of the idea that politics might go away.
No. Politics will never go away. I think, what's it, Corey Robbins' line, is that socialists will disallow ordinary unhappiness. I mean, it'll never go away.
Right.
I don't think that at all.
But okay, so let me drag you back here and let me sort of, and I'm going to just make a thrust here and say, here's what Hans Speier might say, and you know a lot about more about Hans Speier than I do. The only thing I know about Hans Speier is what I've learned from you. But what he might say is that we cannot have any confidence that there will be a democratic politics in the United States that will enable any kind of consensus in the time frame that is necessary to manage the problem of climate change, right?
Right.
If we fail to manage the problem of climate change, then we can toss out any sort of question about creating a more materially just world, because there will be dramatic and short-term, medium-term, and long-term collapses in a variety of foundational things that we need to live. And so, therefore, we ought to treat climate change in the same way that back in the 1940s and the 1950s, we thought about the Cold War, and, you know, sort of accept that democracy ain't going to get us there.
Well, we are failing to address climate change right now in the world that actually exists, which I should say in the undemocratic world exists, in which United States government, in part bought by business interests, is not taking the business unfriendly steps required to actually address climate change. Or I forget where I read it, it might have been Pankaj Mishra, sort of quarter steps like the Paris climate agreements, right? We need to take absolutely radical and frankly anti-business and anti-capitalist steps in order to actually arrest climate change. So I would just say the world that we actually live in is not addressing it in a meaningful way, so we might as well try something different. Or to put it even more bluntly, the world that Speier helped create is not addressing the absolutely existential, potentially existential catastrophe of climate change in a meaningful way.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a great answer, right? I mean, you know, I suspect his answer may be, well, it's because we have not properly reoriented the machinery in the way that it should have been reoriented. But I mean, I don't know. Your answer seems fantastic to me.
That's not real capitalism.
That's always
the answer. And that's the same thing as people saying, lefties saying about the Soviet Union, that's not real socialism, right? That's not an answer.
There are clearly
tendencies in these ideologies that we always need to be aware of. But I would just say in the actually existing world, we've tried one system for quite a while. Hasn't been working out too well either for most people or the world. So I'd say, why don't we try something else?
Right. Okay. So I do then want to sort of drag back to this imperial question, and you started answering it, so maybe I'll just let you say what you were going to say.
Sure. I think that's a really big problem. So I think in an ideal world, what you do in as short a time and as quickly as possible is try to create democratic constituencies in the areas of the world that will be affected by, for example, reducing carbon emissions in what I prefer to call the global south, what some people refer to as the developed world. I think you'd actually want to create some sort of democratic constituencies in these spaces. But even more importantly, I think any sort of climate change effort that is going to harm areas of the global south needs to be accompanied by a global redistributive effort where the global north redistributes some of the resources that it's rapaciously seized over the past 500 years from the global south to help people deal with the disruptions that will necessarily be caused by climate change legislation and climate change agreements. But I do think the most important thing to that is really just diplomacy, that the United States really needs to engage with China and India in order to reduce carbon emissions. Otherwise, we're frankly all doomed. So I do think that there are going to be different considerations in the short term, in the moments of true emergency and crisis, than there are going to be in the medium and long terms. But the important thing is we can't do what Speier did and focus entirely on the short term at the expense in the medium of long term, at the expense of the medium and long terms. Otherwise, we'll definitely create a different world than the one in which we want to live.
Right. And so I mean, I can see a variety of actual sort of existing policies. I bristle a little bit about just sort of the way that sort of rapaciously stealing resources, right? I mean, because it's both true and not true, right? Because it sort of creates this vision that and part of this is true. No. Well, labor, right? that it sort of creates this image that people are simply carting silver out of Oblivion Mine, which actually happened and was extraordinarily devastating. But what we're talking about when we are talking about redistributing the resources that the Global North has sort of taken from the Global South, you know, we're not talking about shipping back silver, right? We're talking about intellectual property policies, right? We are talking about low-term loans. We're talking about financial aid, those sorts of things, which are sort of designed to create sustainable, strong economic and social conditions in parts of the Global South, parts of the developing world, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I think I just mean it in the sense that North Atlantic prosperity is built on the exploited labor and the seizure of raw materials that has been occurring for 500 years. And I don't think we could ignore that. I think that's crucial to understand what needs to be done in sort of a reparations-esque policy, even if we don't want to call it that. I think the North Atlantic has – I think that's the accurate historical neutral language. It's rapaciously seized both labor and goods from particular areas of the world and has been doing so and has created structures that allow this to continue for literally centuries.
Right. I mean, I think the historical record is uneven on that particular question. I mean, if we go to the Piketty, right, that the amount where there, you know, he looked at significant differences between the way that different northern Atlantic countries have taken and different northern countries such as Japan have taken with respect to sort of the seizure of raw materials. And I would say the seizure of labor is more important than the seizure of raw materials. And the labor is more important both in the sense of sort of the direct importation of labor from Africa and from other places, and sort of the utilization of poorly compensated Global South labor in the Global South and at times in the Global North is sort of more important than – is a better way to think about it than the raw materials question.
I mean – sure. I mean, I'm not gonna disagree that the labor was actually absolutely central. But also, if you think of sugar plantations, which absolutely one made that labor possible by providing energy, and two was used as a raw material for hundreds of years, or cotton, you know, in the Caribbean and the American South. Or, you know, as you were saying, gold and silver in Bolivian mines, or oil, you know, throughout the entire Global South in various ways.
Right, although the problem with oil is really that different actors in the Global South are being overcompensated the production of oil. But
contributing to, quote unquote, picked winners, you know, within societies.
No, I completely agree. And picked winners in really disruptive ways. Right.
Yeah. And the way I put it is distorted organic developments that would have otherwise occurred in really destructive ways, as you just said.
Fair. Okay. That's a way that makes sense to me. And that probably goes beyond what we need to be talking about anyway. So, okay. Well, we have gone beyond our time. Do you have anything else that you want to say?
No, this was really fun. And then thanks for inviting me on. I really enjoyed listening to you for years at this point. So thank you.
Well, fantastic. Well, we hope we'll have you again. I know that my colleague, Laurie Skinsomani, Dan Nexon, has also taken interest in the conversation. He couldn't be here today, but, and hopefully we will have another one of these, and we already have some ideas for a future podcast. So, Lawyers, Guns, and Money listeners, thank you so much for joining us. And Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. And once again, LGM listeners, if you have a chance, check out Daniel's book, Democracy in Exile. And you also have another book on humanitarian intervention. Is that correct?
No. I just have a review coming out about Samantha Powers.
All right.
That's it.
So pay attention to forthcoming reviews from Daniel about stuff, and we will actually note those on the blog as well.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find good music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through a PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.